Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2003. For the library, and it's a great honor tonight to be able to welcome Pumla Gobodo-Mandikizela. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Great. To say that I was moved by her book would be a great understatement. As Kirkus Reviews has noted, about a human being died that night, a South Africa story of forgiveness. There's much forgiving to be done in the world, and this primer in compassion makes a fine start. So make no mistake, this is a very, very timely book, and we're really lucky to have Pumla here with us today. I just want to thank Artists for a New South Africa, who have a table out in the lobby and have literature out there. Also, the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which raises the money to make these programs possible, and I hope you'll consider becoming a library associate. There are brochures out in the lobby, and also a sign-up for so you can hear about other programs. I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to Pumla, her accomplishments, and then I'll let her give a little background to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission history before we begin our conversation. Pumla Gobodo-Mandikizela was born in Langa Township in Cape Town, South Africa. She pursued graduate studies at Rhodes University, an apartheid-area whites-only university where blacks had to obtain approval from the Minister of Education to study for degrees not offered by universities designated for blacks. She qualified as a clinical psychologist and earned a doctoral degree from the University of Cape Town. She has been the recipient of many awards from leading institutions, including Harvard, USC, UCLA, and the University of Michigan. And she's held teaching positions at the Kennedy School of Government, Brandeis University, Stanford, Wellesley. And she has also offered workshops for college and high school students in summer institutes run by a wonderful group called Facing History in Ourselves. And Facing History in Ourselves is opening a very large exhibit here in the library tomorrow. So this is a great prelude to that, and I hope you'll all come back and see this very important exhibit and the allied programming that goes along with that. She was the only psychologist on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's Human Rights Violations Committee in the Western Cape. And while serving in that capacity, she decided to interview Eugene de Kock, the man known as Prime Evil, for his relentless pursuit and extermination of anti-apartheid activists. With that introduction, Pumla, would you give us a little bit of background on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Thank you so much, and good evening to you all. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you. 10 years ago, the interim constitution of South Africa was agreed upon at the multi-party negotiations. And the interim constitution had an addendum that provided for the legal framework of this for the establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The goals of the commission were stated very clearly in this postamble of the interim constitution, primary among which were to give as complete a picture as possible of the gross human rights violations committed in the past during the years of apartheid. The Truth Commission had as its major focus the reconciliation of South African black and white people and all political parties from both sides of the political conflict. This was a new approach to dealing with criminals of an oppressive regime. It was a mode of accountability that focused not on the retribution of punishment, but on the restoration of the dignity of both victims and perpetrators. The commission worked on the basis of public testimonies it allowed victims to talk about the violations that happened, that had occurred to them, the traumas that they had suffered in the past, in the public eye of the society of South Africa. It also confronted perpetrators with this requirement as well. Perpetrators were promised amnesty in exchange for truth-telling. This was not blanket amnesty, but it was amnesty granted on condition that they gave full disclosure of all the atrocities they'd committed, including the line of command who gave them orders and who were the upper echelons that ordered these atrocities and provided the guidelines for the commitment of these atrocities. Most important among these conditions was political motive. These crimes for which they are applying for amnesty had to be politically motivated. In other words, there had to be evidence that they were based on the ideology of the apartheid regime or the ideology of the organizations that were fighting apartheid. And finally, the crimes had to be commensurate with the political motive that they were claiming. And so it was that we started the work of the Truth Commission based on the function of three committees. The first was the Human Rights Violations Committee, of which I was a part. This committee set up hearings for victims of atrocities and invited statements from victims throughout the country. The second committee was the Reparations and Rehabilitation Committee, which made recommendations to the president on how victims of atrocities were to be compensated. The third committee, and the most controversial, was the Amnesty Committee, which was responsible for granting amnesty to perpetrators on both sides, apartheid perpetrators as well as those in the liberation movement. It was not a perfect process, but it was certainly an important process for breaking the cycles of violence that so often repeat themselves historically. The mode of the work of the commission was really a redefinition of justice, redefined justice, so that what we understood as evil was now something that was forgivable. Understanding evil within the criminal justice system tells us that you return hatred and violence with revenge or some form of revenge, whether it is through the courts or by action. Now, the commission redefined that modality and allowed people to explore a new way of responding to violence and to hatred. And hopefully that will come up in the conversations this evening. Thank you.
And I just want to assure you that you will have a chance to ask your questions as well after we have our conversation and before the book signing. Pumla, you said many surprising things in your book, and one of the most startling to me was that of the two sides of de Kock that were revealed to you, one evil, one a human being capable of feeling, crying, and knowing pain, it was the latter that you were more afraid of. Could you explain why to us?
May I explain where this comes from first? In my first encounter with Eugene de Kock, that first meeting I had with him, press to also tell the audience who de Kock was.
Yes, that's what I just asked was number two. Could you tell us, why don't you begin with your first impressions of him and go from there? That would be great.
Yes, Eugene de Kock was the commander of apartheid's covert operations unit. He was the head of this secret farm just outside of the capital of South Africa, Pretoria. And he was provided with millions of taxpayers' money to train death squads, men who were sent out to assassinate anti-apartheid activists wherever they were, abroad, in the neighboring states, within the country. He drew his team of death squads from black collaborators as well as white policemen. And so this is the man who he was. This is who de Kock was. He had committed numerous murders that he himself does not remember. He does not know how many people he had killed. He was often involved in himself in the murderous operations. Now, that first meeting I had with him, I walked into the prison room. He's the only, probably one of the very, very few perpetrators of apartheid atrocities who is serving a sentence. He's serving 212 years in prison and two life sentences. He was granted amnesty for many of his crimes, but not for the ones for which he's serving life sentences. So he remains in prison. The first meeting I had with him, I was not sure what to expect. I knew I wanted to see him because widows of some of his victims had forgiven him. And I wanted to establish the extent of his apology, whether he meant his apology and how remorseful he was. And when I asked him to describe to me what his experience was of this encounter with the widows, he just broke down. He broke down and he was trembling and he had tears in his eyes. And as he spoke to me in response to my question, he said, I wish I could do much more than I'm sorry. I wish I could bring their husbands back alive. I wish I could say, here are your husbands. But unfortunately, I cannot undo that. And as I saw him, I felt at that moment that this is a man who is feeling the pain of the evil that he has caused, the terrible deeds that he had committed, and the hurt, the irreparable hurt that he had caused his victims, and was trying to undo what he had done. So I, in an instinctive response, I reached out and touched him and touched his trembling hands. And so this is part of the struggle. I had initially intended to see de Kock just for that one meeting, 2.5 hours at most. But then because of what happened in that meeting, I decided to go back because it seemed to me that there was, after all, a human being behind this evil caricature that everyone knew as Prime Evil. His nickname in South Africa is Prime Evil. And so I kind of thought that there was something there that I had to reach out to and find out why it was silenced all these years.
And many, many questions spun off from that. The one of the most profound meditations in the book is your physical sensations from touching his hand. Maybe you could tell us, I mean, it literally was the trigger hand, you realized later.
Yes, in touching de Kock's hand at that moment, I really did not immediately think of it as something wrong or as something uncomfortable. It was something I was just reaching out in the way that we do when friends or even strangers are in pain. You when someone is asking for empathy, you respond accordingly because they are human beings and you are responding with empathy in the way that, you know, one does in these circumstances. But it was not until afterwards that I questioned this gesture. Driving back, just leaving prison, I started to wonder about what it means to touch somebody in that compassionate way, what it means to be in a close room, so close to a person who had killed so many of my people so brutally. And in fact, when I woke up the following morning, I couldn't lift my hand. Just getting up in the morning, I realized that, my goodness, I couldn't lift my hand. It was numb. It was totally numb. And for a long, anxious moment, it was just numb. I could not raise it from just lift it. And I realized why I could not lift my hand. It was because this is the hand that had reached out to touch de Kock. So my body was reacting to this deed, to this gesture of compassion, and with repulsion, if you may, although intellectually and emotionally, I did not see it as experience it at the time as something wrong. But the body was, you know, all of these messages that we are taught, you know, about what evil is and how we should not touch evil. And here I was in the shoes of a perpetrator, in the shoes of an evil, a man that I had known as evil. And so the reaction was based on all this memory in my body, and this is why I couldn't lift my hand. And the story of the trigger hand is something that he himself pointed out, because much as I was struggling with touching him, he was also struggling with being touched by me. And in the 2 weeks before we met again, he came to the Truth and Reconciliation, the 2 weeks before we had a proper interview, he came to the offices of the Truth Commission to give testimony during a hearing, a victim's hearing. And he asked for me to, he sent someone to call for me. So I went out to the room where the perpetrators were sitting during a break. And immediately, I could see when I walked in, I saw he was very clearly pleased to see me, and he just rushed through the greetings and clearly with something to say. And he said, he thanked me. He said, "Thank you for the other day," and referring to the time when I reached out to him with compassion. And then, with an intent look on his face, he said, "Pumla, do you know that was my trigger hand you touched?" And so this meditation that you talk about is really a reflection on what does this statement mean. And I go back and forth, just exploring the moral dilemma that all of this experience of touching him and now what he was telling me, all of that, just exploring what it means and going back and forth and trying to figure out what is he about and what am I about.
And it's so amazing, because that hand imagery comes back when de Klerk says, my hands are clean. One of the things that you talk about in the book is, you know, what is the responsibility of the society and in terms of its foot soldiers? I mean, if de Klerk thought what he was doing was, if he bought the whole line, you know, he's, you know, the government's trying to wipe out communism. Mm-hmm. It's trying to wipe out the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. You know, the church bought into this too, as well, in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so he was carrying out what he believed to be the right thing. Yes. Now, did he really? So where, you ask, where was his conscience in this? Where did it go?
Yes, I asked that question, and I asked him so many times. I asked it of myself, wondering where it was, and I asked him as well, where was your conscience? Why didn't you stop doing this? And if you had these moments of doubt, why did you continue to become the head of a covert operations that murdered people so brutally? And the thing about these gross human rights violations is that they hide their true meaning to the people who commit them. It's almost as if they know, but they don't know. They know that they are wrong, or they are, you know, they are outside the realm of morality. But at the same time, because there is so much strong evidence that they are doing the right thing from the society of white people who benefited from apartheid, who seemed to be, you know, urging them on, and then their leadership, who were awarding them with all the medals. De Klerk is one of the people who received the highest medal, the Police Star, I think it was called. And so they were constantly being rewarded. And the society, nobody was asking the questions that they were supposed to be asking. This issue of choosing to pass, this question about how do you speak out, how do you take that stand and speak out against evil, against atrocities, is a very important question to be asked, not only after events such as apartheid, but constantly to ourselves as the world evolves, as evil happens around us. These are the questions that we ask. But one of the things I say in the book, in my reflection on where were these voices? Why were people silent? And why did people allow these things to happen? It's not as if they did not know that there were cross-border operations, that there were assassinations, that there were these secret death squads going on. It was, although it was not overtly stated, people would have been in a cage not to know that these things were happening in South Africa. They did. But at the same time, they were silent about, so why did it not happen? And I, my own conclusion about this is that, or my own observation, is that when one is in the midst of these evil deeds, this terrible, terrible evil deeds, and when one is instilled with so much fear that there is an enemy out there that is supposed to be feared, people believe anything. People are not able to stand at a critical distance and reflect on what is going on in order to see the truth about what is going on. When you are afraid, and this unfortunately is what normal, ordinary people are, ordinary people are often afraid when they are told that there's an enemy out there, you are in danger. They're often afraid and they cannot dissociate themselves from that mood of just so much fear. And so this is why these silences develop.
And you talk about that too with the necklace killings, that on the side of black bystanders, that they felt like they had failed their youth by not preventing it, mm-hmm. and also by not allowing it to happen at all, in a sense. So it's cultivating that awareness of how do you stop something before it gets to that mm-hmm. point that mm-hmm. you want to develop in a society. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, isn't the issue of, you talk about this somewhat in the book, of understanding perpetrators in itself somewhat controversial in the field? Could you talk about that a little bit?
It is very controversial. There's always the belief that when you try to understand, you overstep the limits between condoning something and explaining something. Understanding is often seen as explaining away evil. When you try to understand evil, the fear is always that you are giving it language, you're giving it words, you're making it understandable, you're making it acceptable to the mind. You are making something that is otherwise unspeakable and indescribable more acceptable to the mind. And yet, you cannot change these behaviors. You cannot learn from these things if you do not try to understand how they came about in the first place. And my own view is that understanding is not forgiving terrible things. Understanding is really a sense of charting the pathway, and trying to draw the line between what is humanly possible and what is avoidable, I think. And so when you learn what the pathway was, what the turning points were in this person's life, like de Kock, then you're able to understand how things could have been done differently, or how he could have avoided that behavior, or how the structures or the institutions that encourage him to commit these atrocities could have been perhaps repositioned in society so that people are not caught up in the swing of things, that people are able to stand back and be critical about these things. So understanding is very critical, particularly when you are dealing with the past, a violent past conflict. It's important to start to begin with how do you understand these atrocities, to acknowledge that they happened, but then to begin to understand, to explain how they happened, not meaning that you are condoning them. The danger, of course, with trying to understand is that you have to be empathetic when you understand some, when you want to understand some, you have to someone put yourself in the shoes of the other person, so that you understand how they got there in the first place. And that is always the critical point.
That's why I wanted to bring up, you wrote an op-ed piece recently for the New York Times in which you were able, I mean, you have an extraordinary capacity to be able to see from the viewpoint of the other. I mean, it's really remarkable. And in this op-ed piece, you tell us what is behind the Afrikaner, the right-wing Afrikaners now in South Africa, and how they feel betrayed. And to have you be able to explain that, I thought was not only extraordinary, but you mention your mother in it at the end, and you say that, you know, she could live with this great bitterness right now. You know, she's someone who suffered under the regime of apartheid, but she chooses not to. So I wanted to ask, who obviously you've had much education and you've had much study, but what allows you, in a sense, to be able to see into the other? What in your background or in your family do you think kind of instilled that idea in you? Does it come from your family?
It comes from a variety of experiences. My family, my experiences as a young person who had an opportunity to engage in these, at the time they were called encounter groups, groups that were run by churches in South Africa, the liberal churches, trying to bring young white people, young white students and black students together in encounter group on a long-term basis, to engage them, to let them interact with one another. So it's really, and also just the sense of being tired about being angry. You know, I was angry as a young person, and certainly many of my friends and colleagues were angry when we were in high school and when we were even in at university. But then there comes a time when you reach a certain level of your own development, or perhaps a moment of transcendence, that, you know, there's so many of these moments, but you realize that hatred and anger does not build, does not help transform you. And I think it's just this desire to become a human being, which is really a journey that so many of us engage in. We engage in these journeys throughout our lives. We are constantly seeking to become whole human beings. And I think part of being a human being is to recognize the pain that you cause others by your actions or your inactions. And so by reaching out to these higher levels, if I may, the higher levels of being, the higher levels of becoming human, the being able to really embrace the true meaning of humanity, which is being able to see another person's humanity, or at least opening yourself up to the possibility of seeing the humanness of another person. And so it's an evolving process. It's a journey that I think we all engage in when we reach a certain level. You just want to be to seek, you know, higher ground. You are constantly just searching for ways of becoming more whole. And I think being a human being, many of us and all of us, we understand that being a human being is really about being compassionate towards others and being reaching out to others with compassion whenever we can. The burden, of course, I mean, in these cases, the burden is on the perpetrator. The burden is not on victims of human rights abuses to become forgiving, to be empathic. The burden is on the perpetrator to give the victims cause to reach out with their empathy.
That's what I wanted to talk about next, is the dynamics of forgiveness, because I think you lay them out in a really something that people can really grasp here. You mentioned that at the commission, that when someone would be in the act of forgiving someone, that Archbishop Tutu would call for silence. And he said, because we are on holy ground, that there's something holy or sacramental about forgiveness. So I have a number of questions. One of this is, let's start with the dynamics of what is an apology. What you say that apology, there's certain things that has to happen in an apology in order for it to perform, in order for those words to have the effect on the victim that might allow them to consider whether they want to forgive or not. What are those aspects that the apology has to do?
The primary one is acknowledgement. It's acknowledgement, full acknowledgement, which is really about truth telling. People want to hear the truth. And secondly, people want to know that when you apologize, you do not rationalize the act. You apologize unconditionally. When you say, I'm sorry, but you know, this was this and this was that, or I apologize for what I did, but during those days, you know, the apartheid government was killing our people. You know, you apologize unconditionally. People want to hear an unconditional apology, an apology that speaks to the victim and that recognizes the pain that you caused the victim. And the one way that makes an apology speak is remorse, is regret and remorse. When you demonstrate that you regret what you did and you feel remorse for what you did, in other words, you feel pain for the pain that you have caused this other person. And that is where the gravity of the moment lies. That is the gravity of the of an apology. It is remorse, because remorse is, from the perspective of the perpetrator, is the moment when they are acting like human beings. They are acting like human beings. They are showing that what they denied for so long, for the first time, they recognize that they have a conscience that lives and they are responding to that conscience. And the paradox of that moment is that it is the pain of the perpetrator, that moment of remorse where the perpetrator lays himself bare in front of the victim, sort of lays himself naked, as you may, and asks and begs to be forgiven. And it is that brokenness, it is that sense of being so pained and broken that touches the victim to the core and invites them to reach out with forgiveness. And that is really the where the gravity of the moment lies, and that is what leads victims to reach out with forgiveness. They are responding to the pain of remorse.
And then what power lies with the victim in granting forgiveness? What is it that they are then able to do, and what might it do for them?
They're holding the gates, they're holding the door to this desire for the perpetrator to rejoin the realm of moral humanity. They can deny or give forgiveness. They hold the key to what the perpetrator desires so much, so deeply. And so this endows them, endows victims with a lot of power. And in a way, it helps them, it restores the victim's dignity in both in the sense of giving them the power that the perpetrator needs something from them, mm-hmm. and also because by recognizing that they caused them pain and acknowledging the wrongdoing and feeling the pain of remorse, they are really recognizing the humanity of the victim, which they denied at the time of the perpetration of the crime. When perpetrators commit their deeds, they dehumanize the victim. They dehumanize the person that you, as the family member, the surviving family member, you loved so much as a human being. And so when they say, "I did wrong, I beg your forgiveness," they are recognizing that that was a life, that person was in pain. And so in a way, they're rehumanizing the victim. They are reconstituting the victim as a human being, even in death. They're really redefining that moment now when they shattered the victim's world and reconstituting that moment so that the victim can now be with their loved one again in order to let them go and begin the road of mourning. As one of the family, these widows said, they said, "We, de Kock has done something great for us. De Kock has told us the truth. He has allowed us to retrace the steps so that we retrace our husband's steps so that we can be with them in life and release them in death and begin the road towards mourning." So it is that important for the victims to hear those words, because for them, they are present with the loved one. When they go through the details of how it happened, they are present with them again so that they can now mourn properly. They know the truth. This is the old adage, "The truth sets you free." It's true on both sides. It sets you free because for the victim, they are free of this hatred and the bitterness. They get rid of the bitterness and the hatred and they can move on. And for the perpetrator, they are free of the guilt, not entirely free, but at least symbolically, in a symbolic sense, they've been cleansed of the guilt by the mere fact of being granted forgiveness. They are being cleansed of the guilt that they've been carrying for so many years.
I was telling Pumla a little bit before about a group I've worked with a little bit called One by One, which was founded by Holocaust survivors, descendants, perpetrators, and bystanders. And I read an interesting paper recently. You must know Dr. Paula Green's work. She's at the Peace Center in Vermont. They sent a contingent.
I know the Peace Center
in
Vermont.
They sent a contingent to Bosnia from One by One. So it was a group of a German, two Germans, two Jews. The Germans, each pair had worked with each other in dialogue for a long time, and their idea was to model for this Muslim and Serb group how they had worked together, these two people. Of course, this is a generation later. Mm. And Paula Green had written, "We do not use the language of forgiveness and reconciliation, but rather select more present-oriented words such as relationship, community building, collaboration, and healing. I sense that forgiveness and reconciliation, if they develop, grow out of this larger journey of rebuilding trust and restoring relations. I believe that we cannot wait 50 years for the second generation to undertake the healing process, and indeed, postponement is a sacrifice of the second generation." So I guess my question is, are there ongoing groups, dialogue groups in South Africa to continue this healing? And when is too soon? When, can you approach reconciliation before there's a shattering of trust? Can you work on it? Is there before? Is there after? What is your sense of timing?
I think the timing, the immediacy is as important as if it were to happen much later. If it did not happen, it must happen at some point. It's important that it happened earlier, because then there is a face, there is a name, there are people identifiable who did the deed. And this is what happened in South Africa. These perpetrators were within the same generation, and they were identified and they were put on the stage and shamed in public. And so, and then they, some of them, rose to the extraordinary historical moment and apologized and felt remorse. And it's really a question of what language do you use to understand what is going on? Because forgiveness is about restoring the dignity of victims and of perpetrators as well. It's about opening possibilities for new relationships. It's really, it's a new approach to violence, a new approach to revenge. So it is an approach that encourages, that opens the door to a creation of relationships. If it's not forgiveness or if it's not reconciliation, then at least coexistence or respect of one's neighbors. So whatever language you use, creating this space encourages these kinds of relationships to happen. It's not, the question is no longer whether victims will forgive perpetrators or whether victims will engage with perpetrators, but the question is, how do you create these moments that make it possible for this kind of dialogue to happen.
How about your questions? I want to save some time for you. Yes, sir.
They were broadcast live. They were broadcast live on what would be the equivalent of the National Public Radio in this country. The South African Broadcasting Corporation had simultaneous broadcasting of these hearings, all of the hearings, the amnesty hearings as well as victims' hearings. They were also, in addition, they were televised programs. There was a regular weekly televised programs, snippets of what happened in the week, as well as reports each evening of hearings that happened on a particular day. And so in that sense, the whole nation was involved. People were forced to watch. Those who did not watch, who turned off their televisions, still, the story was in the air. It was out there. It was impossible to deny that these things happened.
And I should mention there's an extraordinary documentary film, which hopefully we'll be able to show here at the library sometime. It's shown a little bit, I think, in downtown recently, called A Long Night's Journey Into Day, which is a beautiful document of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Quite beautiful. Yes?
Hi. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Oh.
Oh,
wow. And one
people who work with trauma will always suffer the after effects of listening to traumatic stories. And the challenge is, how do you go on and on? How are you present? How can you be present for victims of trauma without damaging yourself? And so some of us had support groups that we went to after the hearings, and some of us had spiritual groups, and people dealt with it in different ways. The problem is that this was not your usual sort of, you know, therapeutic encounter where it's defined as a professional process. In fact, even when it is professional, sometimes when it comes to trauma, it's hard not to be affected by trauma. And particularly these kinds of experiences that were almost like your own story. You know, the stories that I listened to on the commission were very much like my story. And I talk a bit about that in the book, because in a way you relive your own history when it is told on the stage of the commission, but you have to have strategies to deal with it, and we had different strategies. My strategy was to write fervently when people were testifying. I would write and translate, write in the language that the testimony was given, and then give my own English translation, because often the translations were not entirely accurate. And so that intellectual process sort of distanced me from the immediacy of the trauma and allowed me to stand a little, you know, removed from the emotional impact of the testimony. And so, I mean, it was, and then, of course, you know, you sleep. I slept for an average of 2 hours every day. There was a hearing, and eventually realized I have to start taking some sleeping tablets. And so that's the reality of working in traumatic situations. All people who work with trauma, whether it's the trauma of rape, or, you know, the rape crisis, or any, you know, or the trauma of refugees, these are the kinds of symptoms that people who work in these conditions, under these conditions, have to face. And it's just the reality of this kind of work. Now, the forgiveness and the reconciliation, why the country was able to move in this direction, it's really, I think that these processes are possible in every region if the situation is created, if the right leaders at the right moment define the relationships in this way, then I think that there are many places where this kind of response could emerge. Of course, one cannot expect a duplication of the work of the Truth Commission, because there are other cultural issues as well, you know, which the evening is short, but there are other, so I cannot go into detail about it, but there are other cultural experiences or cultural beliefs that sort of place people in South Africa in a situation where they are more open to this kind of thing. Archbishop Tutu talks about Ubuntu, which is really what it means. It's hard to translate, but it's in a sense it's we constitute our shared humanity. Your humanity is constituted by mine, and I constitute your humanity, that you depend on me to become a human being, and vice versa. And so I cannot deny you your humanity if you desire it from me. In other words, if you beg forgiveness, or if you beg to be readmitted in the world of moral humanity, I can't keep you out, because if I do that, then I am becoming the thing that I despise in you. You understand? So it's that kind of thing, that you can't return. If you return hatred with hatred, then you are repeating the cycles of evil, that you don't want to become white to hate in the other person. Now, it's not you know, it's much more complex than that, as I'm sure we all appreciate. And some of it depends really on the degree of the preparedness of perpetrators to recognize that what they did is evil. If there are denials and if there are rationalizations and justifications, then it's hard for people who have been hurt and wounded to open up with humanity. And so it works in both ways.
You made an interesting comparison in the book between the kind of cut-off under apartheid, kind of denying that you were a part of it, and under Nazi Germany, where you basically thought that there was nothing wrong with what you were doing. That was a really key difference.
Yes, and it's a very interesting one, I think, just in terms of understanding the evil, the amount of evil that was done under Nazi rule. The apartheid evil did not reach the levels that enabled them to engage in what the Nazis did in the final solution, to devise the final solution, the hatred of blacks in South Africa. There was a measure of guilt that was sort of constantly there, and I think that it is part because they knew what the truth is, and somehow they were, all of the presidents of South Africa were members of the Dutch Reformed Church, so there was always the presence of that voice, although they nevertheless redefined a biblical text to suit their laws so that they are more acceptable to their constituents. But still, there was that voice was always present. It was always there. They knew that it's wrong, so that they were unable to really deny that this is evil. They knew it's evil, which is why they are now maintaining that these people broke the law. You know, the Nazis who appeared at the Nuremberg trials were all proudly, you know, declaring that this was the law, you know, and some of them, in fact, were hailing Hitler right to the gallows, and some were dressed in their uniform. But here, and these were men who were very high up in the power line, and many of them, in fact, had to declare allegiance to Hitler as greater than God, and to abandon their Christian values because Hitler was now higher than God. But in South Africa, this was not the case. The apartheid leaders like de Klerk are washing their hands. They say people like Eugene de Kock, who I write about in the book, broke the law. They were not under orders. They broke the law. And yet, de Kock and others were operating under covert operations. And by definition, covert operation, that's all the order you're going to be given. It's a covert operation. Do what you have to do to get the job done. There aren't going to be any orders, any clear orders. You know, they were told, you know, eliminate this person, remove them from society. And so when they were confronted with their own words before the commission, they said, oh, we never said kill. We said eliminate, which means we said arrest and take to prison. We never said remove from society. By removing from society, kill them. They took the law in their hands. We did not instruct them to do that.
In fact, wasn't there, you call it the 11th commandment?
The 11th commandment, yes, was thou shalt not be found out. So that is what they believed. This was covert operations. They were given so millions of money. I mean, it was an institution. The murder of anti-apartheid activists was an institution, and so there was no way that the government did not know about it.
Back there?
Thank you.
Did everyone hear the question? Whether the United States might, you said, go through a similar process? Benefit from a similar process.
There are lessons to be drawn from the work of the Truth Commission in South Africa. And for me, when we try to understand how it could be applied in this country. The key for me is the acknowledgement issue. We often believe that something that happened long time ago in the past, centuries ago, you know, slavery happened so many years ago in the centuries ago, and there are no victims, direct victims, nor are there any direct perpetrators. Those slave masters are now long gone. And yet, traumatic memory is never past. It's never past. It is in fact present. It's a constant. People who experience trauma pass on their experiences within their families from generation to generation. These are narratives that define the identity of these people, the people who have been traumatized. And so these are carried on throughout the generations. In psychology, we talk about the transgenerational transmission of trauma, so that it may be the fourth generation, but the story is still there. The whole history of this family, of this community, of these people is imbued by this with this history of atrocity, which is remembered in so many ways, both in terms of something that happened in the past, but also is something that is very much a part of who the people are as a group of people who experience this trauma, particularly if the circumstances, present circumstances, are similar to the present circumstances evoke the memory of that past. So that past is never dead. It's very much a present. And so because of that fact, it is important to recognize how important it is, how significant a process of acknowledgement would be for people who had experienced trauma, no matter how far away it is. And then, of course, one of the lessons of the commission is that when you engage in a dialogue about the past, one has to watch that one does not alienate another group. It's important that you engage in the dialogue, not in a way of judging and pointing fingers, because if you do that, then you lose all the value of this process. What is key is that you invite people from both sides to talk about how do we rebuild? How do we rebuild this society? How do we benefit from a process of dialogue? Because the irony, much as people constantly talk about how much this thing is past, there are so many white people who feel guilty about this. When you raise the subject of racism or you raise the subject of slavery, there is a lot of guilt. Now, the reason there is guilt is that that memory stays with white people as well. And it does not mean that they are responsible for these terrible deeds, but it means that the memory stays with them. So precisely because there are these experiences of this is how the history is remembered by both sides, it's about time that we got together, that the two sides got together to somehow find a language to talk about it. Not language that is going to judge and point fingers, but rather language that is going to help bring the two sides together so that the engagement is healthy and healing. And symbols are important. People often say, oh, what does this mean? You know, these are just words, you know, there should be something concrete. Of course, concrete effects will emerge out of that process, but symbols provide hope. And hope is the stuff that really steers people on to action. But without that beginning of dialogue, the beginning of acknowledgement of the pain on both sides, then there is no way that you can build that social cohesion that is so important for the process of healing.
Right here.
I think that it is really in these kinds of conversations that even to talk about your own pain becomes a possibility. And it's when we trust the space and when we feel that we will be heard that you can reach out in this way. If there is no space and if there is a lot of hostility, if memory is used to rekindle old hatreds, then we cannot build. But if memory is used to rebuild or to begin new relationships, then that is where the hope is. And that is where the hope is, really. And I really believe that there is nothing, you're not going to, you know, break the skies or do something, you know, that will shatter the earth. But it is in these small steps, in the small spaces where we are, that we will be able to make a difference in life among people that we love, we care for. The challenge is to begin, to acknowledge, to really recognize, and to recognize that this is the truth. You know, what you just shared now is the deepest truth, and this is what makes it so easy to engage with one another. But if that truth is not told, then there is no way that we can move. Thank you very much.
And I want to thank you all, and thank Pumla. We could go on for a long time, but I can think of no better place to begin and end. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.